Very interesting article I read on the Daily Maverick earlier today. Informal settlements could drive South Africa's rooftop solar revolution. Professor David Everett, co-author of that article with Professor Imran Volodia. And David Everett is Professor of Urban Governance at Wits University and principal investigator of the project about which he will now talk. Hello, David.
Good afternoon.
How does one get to a rooftop solar revolution in informal settlements?
Probably through some lateral thinking on our part. But the work that we're doing through the project that I'm running involves a lot of work. We're in two informal settlements in Gauteng, one called Malusi, which is relatively young, and one called Jeffville, colloquially known as Gomorra, for good reason, in the middle of Attridgeville. And I think there's a very stark contrast between the formal structures in the middle of Attridgeville, all of whose roofs are absolutely covered in solar panels, and the dwellings, both formal and informal, which have none at all. And I think what we were beginning to say is in the townships, formal and backyard dwellings tend to have infrastructure. They tend to have running water, electrical connections. Whether they are currently paid up and working is a separate argument. Whereas informal settlements have none of that. They also don't have things like illegal connections. And so thinking of what has happened in the city of Cape Town, where people are talking about selling power back to the grid, sure, it's great for the wealthy, the big industrial plants. They will generate tons of solar power, and good for all of us if it helps load shedding. But our thinking was you have to try and deal with inequality at the same time. It's not enough just to let the rich who have bought themselves or ourselves out of the grid now being able to make money off that, whereas the poor remain at the bottom of the pile. And so our notion was a lease and own deal, in other words, financed by government, to put solar panels on the roofs of, ideally, virtually every informal settlement, assuming the structure is strong enough and can take it and so on. But if you're living in an informal settlement, enlightened self-interest will drive you to harvest as much sunlight as you can. You'll borrow, you'll get more solar, you'll make more money. And as that happens, hopefully your socioeconomic status improves and things like social demand for social grants declines, because you're aiming, by going for informal settlements, you're going for some of the poorest spaces that exist in South Africa. So it struck us as a kind of very virtuous cycle. I can see any number of problems that people can bring up, but I think it's time that we tried something different rather than making ourselves so nervous of what may go wrong that we don't dare take a step forward.
David, if I think about the shacks that I drive past, inevitably as one exits Cape Town, whichever route one takes out, you go through areas where there has been a proliferation of shacks, and there are plenty of them to see and to feel all sorts of whirly emotions about. But you look at the size of the roof for most of the shacks. They're all roughly the same size. Just in practical terms, what does one practically get onto the roof of an informal settled house? One, two panels?
No, you see, I think that's where the morphology of informal settlements differs quite strongly from region to region. And I think in the Cape, you're very much building on sand, and your foundations are pretty weak. And so the notion of having these very large compounds, which are very common in Gauteng informal settlements, just doesn't seem to really have taken hold. Whereas here you have, in an informal settlement, there could be six or seven dwelling units in a single compound, which in its central courtyard can park three cars. So, I mean, we're talking a very large, expansive roof, probably a third the size of a soccer field, for one big compound. And so in that instance, you're getting an awful lot of, assuming you can afford it, you're getting an awful lot of solar panels on the roof.
And you use the phrase, assuming you can afford it, and you earlier spoke about the multiple objections which can be raised to this, and earlier than that, you said government would have to pay for this. Mm-hmm. I mean, has there been any kind of costing of what this would set government back for a particular area, which one then can multiply to other suitable areas?
You know, the simple answer is no. I mean, we're punting an idea into the debate because it seems a good time to do it, since Cape Town has just started the debate. But I think, you know, if you put it very bluntly, you can pay people a basic income grant, or you can give them the money to get some solar panels. You know, we're already giving an awful lot of money to people who are below a certain threshold. And they consume it, quite rightly, because that's why we give it to them. But we can also switch our focus from just consumable income to this kind of developmental intervention where I'm able to actually earn money by selling this power back to the grid. But however, you know, Eskom wants to do it, there's no point giving people without electricity vouchers against their future bills because they won't have any. So clearly there will have to be a cashback mechanism. And that replaces the social grant that you would have given. But instead you gave solar panels. And I don't want to make it an either or.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if we keep giving people a few hundred rand a month and nothing else, it's the luck of the draw as to whether they find a job and get out of that. If we give them a few hundred rand and some solar panels, it's the luck of the sunshine that will get them out of that particular situation. Because you can remain unemployed but be earning an income. And that's the key to this, is it's not a job creator per se, but it is an income generator. And that can become a business over time.
Have you asked anybody in the areas that might benefit from this whether they would prefer this to a basic income grant? Because, again, you know, maybe I'm underestimating the ability to think far ahead of people who live in these very straitened circumstances. But you know, there's an immediate suspicion that many would say, no, I want the basic income grant because it's cash
absolutely
in my pocket.
Yes, and I don't blame them. I mean, you know, don't give me some solar panels and I won't eat for a month. So clearly there would have to be a bridging moment where you're getting both. And then as your solar begins to pay off, you pay back the grant that you got during that bridging period. I mean, I think there are a number of mechanisms.
Yeah.
I do think it takes education for people on the ground to accept that this is, although, as I say, I do think enlightened self-interest would say, if you just put all these panels on the roof, we will buy the power from you at X, you know, X rand per kilowatt. But I think there's also a lot of education for policymakers, most of whom are, and senior public officials, they're incredibly conservative and risk-averse. And the notion of giving something to the poor or helping buy something for the poor and leaving it to those people to manage and reap benefits from is very much not how this government works.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the conversation is around giving middle-class people like me a tax rebate if I put solar panels on my roof.
Well, I think the conversation is across the board. You know, it's I'm assuming that for middle-class people like us, there will be vouchers against our future bills, and they wouldn't necessarily want to pay us money. I don't know. And that's why we're saying in the article there are lots of possible, both objections and possibilities. You can means test so that below a certain income threshold, people can get cash, and above that they can get vouchers, because above that income, they're almost certainly in a formal dwelling with electricity. The key is to go to places that have no wiring, have not been electrified. And so it saves you ever having to do that. Because you go straight to solar, and in any community, in any informal settlement, I can imagine how many unemployed electricians, carpenters, etc. there are. And for communities to pool their resources and do away, just bypass the entire electrification, go straight to solar, you obviously need a nearby connection to the grid in order to pool that electricity, I mean that power, and send it back to the grid. But that's the infrastructure that's required from the state. It then doesn't have to spend the millions it would have to do to make these into site and service areas by adding power cables. So it does seem to me that the savings for government are quite considerable. There is an outlay, of course, but I think there's a saving that mitigates that.
Yeah, I've been reminded by one of my listeners about a project here in Stellenbosch, and I spoke to Alan Knott-Craig Jr. about this last year sometime, the ISHAC project, the Municipal Indigent Grant for Electricity, is used to fund a small solar system. So there, in a very limited space, something like this is happening. Of the maybe 20 contributions I've had from listeners while you and I have been talking, David, probably 15 of them have said the solar panels will be stolen immediately and sold on.
I mean, I've had a whole bunch of that on the Daily Maverick as well.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, you can raise multiple objections, you know, but the bottom line for me is that if you take an informal settlement, you get their buy-in, you get them to understand what you're providing, and you get them to understand the long-term benefit. My sense is that people will protect what generates revenue for them, particularly if you can show in the first month that there is revenue. If you make people wait 6 months while the red tape is unwound, I'm sure people will sell the panels because they'll want to eat. But if the community as a whole has bought into the program, they will become the safeguards of the solar panels, and their own self-interest will not be in a quick buck, but in a long-term investment. And I think, you know, we often forget that informal settlements are very well organized internally, have very clear rules of governance amongst themselves. They certainly suffer high levels of crime and violence. I don't, you know, deny that, and they're not nice places to be. But they're well organized and well regulated places. And I think if we rely on people's innate ability to regulate their own spaces, I don't see that they'll steal them immediately is necessarily an appropriate response.
Yeah, tell the dreamer he should rather work on birth control pills. I mean, it's just so depressing to have people respond to something which attempts to open a conversation about a different set of possibilities. And people just retreat into their tight ideological lagers instead of going, this is an interesting idea. Okay, that's a problem, but maybe that's a solution to that problem. And this is one of the possibilities. So in order to achieve that possibility, we need to make sure that this and this happens. It's that immediate shutdown of anything that might improve simply because it doesn't fit with their ideological blinkers. Anyway, I'm excited. I really am. Reading and listening to you, David, I'm very excited. And I hope that there is a debate, and I hope the debate leads to some action. Professor David Everett is the Professor of Urban Governance at Wits University.